I've called tonight's talk Searching for the Here and Now, which when you think about it is a bit of a silly title. How could we lose here and now? Here's a few stories for you, brief stories, to introduce the talk. I heard recently that an astronaut on the Apollo 14 mission to the moon, a chap called Ed Mitchell, had a very interesting experience while he was in space. He had what some people called a spiritual epiphany. There was a moment when time stopped for him. There was a blissful space, a timeless space in which he was looking at the Earth. And in that moment he sensed, he had an experience of the interconnectedness of all things. It was a very deep and profound experience for him in this tin can hurtling towards the moon. And it changed his life. It changed the course of his life. He went in to further explore to try and find out what this phenomenon was, what this experience was that he had, of this interconnectedness. Once there was a young man in a South London digs who reached the end of his tether. He reached a point where he realised all his attempts to find peace, happiness, success and fulfilment in life kept on failing. He was never getting to where he wanted to go. Now, this was a particularly neurotic part of this man's life, and a doubt mass arose. He suddenly questioned very deeply the meaning of life, the universe, and everything. He tried to find out what the source of his anguish was, and all he could find out for certain was that it was his thinking that kept leading him into trying all these things that never resulted in his ultimate happiness. In the end, he realized that it was his thinking that was the problem. But all he had was more thinking. He reached a schism in his mind, his neurotic mind, where he believed the next thought that he had would be no good, useless. What to do? In that moment, his mind actually went still because it was the only place left. And he had a spiritual epiphany. He had a realization. He felt it was like grace falling on him. And during that experience, he had a very definite realization that all human beings are searching for the same thing. They're searching for this grace, this peace. It changed his life too. And his life became a conscious search for that grace. He wanted to experience it again. He knew that was the purpose of his life from then on. A man in America has devoted his life to meditating. 20 years of meditation without results. Then one day he's meditating and he hears a bird singing and a thought pops up in his mind. Who hears the bird singing? And the answer immediately flashed up, a realization. There is no one who hears the bird singing. There is no bird singing. There is sound and there is hearing, but there is no one who is doing it. We understand that as anatta. In that moment, he realized directly the reality of emptiness. He was enlightened in that moment. And 2,500 years ago, under the Bodhi tree, Siddhartha Gautama, after a long search for truth and understanding, finally realized. The difference with the Buddha was that not only did he become fully enlightened, he was self-enlightened. He had no teacher. He did it himself. Also, not only did he become enlightened, but he was also able to present a path to anybody who wanted to walk that path to find that self-same peace, that self-same realization, that grace, that recognition of the interconnectedness of all things. There's one thing in common with all these four different stories. At the moment of their epiphany, their awakening, their realization, there was no searching. There was instead one exquisite moment of total seeing. And that's really what I'm going to try and put across tonight, the difference between the search and the seeing. Anyone who realizes the truth agrees that there is that truth is to be found here and now. It's not to be found off in the future. It must be found here and now. It's all around us all the time. There is nothing you need to do, because you cannot produce it, you can't create it, you can't win it through your good behaviour, because it's already in existence. The truth is always here and now. It is what is in reality. But this prevents something of a dilemma and a cause of confusion for people who are actually walking the path. There are some who say, all searching for the truth is a waste of time, because it is all searching that has to come to an end in order for this exquisite moment of seeing to take place. Searching actually hides the truth. And then there is another group of people who say that there is a path you can take, there is a search that you can undertake in order to come to the point where this exquisite moment of total seeing, this epiphany, actually occurs. Now this is a cause of confusion for people who walk a path, because they may read a book by a non-path teacher, somebody who espouses this idea that all search must come to an end. It can cause a bit of confusion, a dilemma. Is walking the path worthwhile? Surely if they're right and all search is futile, then surely I should give up walking the path. Because if I keep walking the path, the realization will never come. A dilemma. How is it resolved? I think the first thing we have to recognize is that both path and non-path teachings are absolutely right. They're not actually in opposition to each other, rather they are, if you like, two sides of the same coin. Let me establish the argument a little bit more for you. Critics of the path say that walking a path, searching for enlightenment, promotes goal orientation. It reinforces this search. You're always looking beyond the here and now. There's always an idea of a future result. Through my endeavours, through practising vipassana, through living a good life, through mental development, through walking the Buddha's path, it's always got an idea attached to it of a future result. In the future, I'll become enlightened. And they suggest that all these paths are red herrings that actually keep you in the dark. Now, critics of non-path teachings say, well, all right then, but how? If you're taking away all volitional actions and saying there's nothing I can do in order to bring this epiphany about, then how do I do it? How does it happen? How does it work? You've left me with nothing to do. Whenever we say that there is another way of seeing the world, there's a way of seeing the world which is transcendental to the way I currently see it, we create a gap, a chasm, a schism. The moment we do that, then there's, all right, then how do I find that? How do I get that? But non-path teachings don't give you that chance. They say you have to give up all search, all inner search, all outer search. It's a bit like the cosmic joke. The big joke is that in order to find nibbana, enlightenment, freedom from suffering, you have to give up all search. But you can't just give a punchline to the joke and expect everyone to laugh. You have to give the preamble too. If I stand here and say, awful, awful, well, you don't really, you might giggle, but you don't really understand what I mean. Awful, awful, why aren't you all laughing? Some of you are already. But if I was to begin it with, my dog's got no nose, and you were to say, well, how does it smell? And I'll say, awful, awful, then you understand the joke, because you have the preamble. So is there something we can do? Is there a search that we can undertake in order to come to the point where we see the futility of all searches? The answer is yes. Well, I got there a little bit early, but never mind. Really, this is the point I'm trying to make in the talk, that path and no path ideas need be of no confusion to anyone once you understand the parameters of what we mean when we say we undertake the path. If you understand the limitations of Vipassana, what it can do for you and its limitations, then it means all the confusion around this no path idea. Because I know a lot of you read no path teachers' books, and that's why I thought it was an important issue to discuss. One important thing I wanted to point out is that in one sense, everyone is searching for enlightenment. It's the part of the realization that young man had in his South London digs. Everyone is actually searching for enlightenment. Most people, it's an unconscious search, and for a few, it's a conscious search. Everyone thinks that life should be perfect, pleasant, secure, eternal, and happy. In a sense, you could say that everyone is seeking the end of all search. They're seeking that point of fulfillment where they don't actually have to search anymore. That's enlightenment. Let me give you a story as an illustration. The mullah, Nasr al-Din, decided that he wanted a wife. But he didn't want any old wife. He wanted to find the perfect wife. He told his friends that he was going off searching for the perfect wife. And a few weeks later, one of his friends saw him in the road and said, "Hey, Nasr al-Din, did you find your perfect wife?" Nasr al-Din said, "I found three women." And his friend asked him, "Well, were any of them suitable? Were any of them perfect?" Nasr al-Din said, "Well, the first woman I met was beautiful. She was so beautiful. Physically, you couldn't wish for a more beautiful woman. But she was so unintelligent. And she didn't have a word to say. There was no common ground. She didn't have a sense of humour. And she had no spiritual dimension to her at all. The second woman I met, she really was intelligent. She had such a wonderful personality. She was so engaging, funny. And she did have a spiritual dimension to her. But she was pig ugly." "What about the third woman, Nasr al-Din?" "The third woman, she was beautiful. Possibly the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And she was intelligent. And she was so funny and was so engaging. And she was one of the most spiritually developed people I've ever met. She was so lovely. She was so perfect." "Well, Nasr al-Din, are you going to marry her? Are you going to marry her?" Nasr al-Din fell silent. "No. Why not, Nasr al-Din? Why not?" "Because," Nasr al-Din said slowly and sadly, "she's looking for the perfect man." And therein lies the problem. We're searching perfection, searching fulfillment. We're searching for the end of all searching. Had Nasr al-Din found her perfect woman, I'm sure it would have, in his eyes, represented the end of that particular search, and thereby an end to the restlessness that he was feeling. And yet it doesn't. The young man in South London became very aware that all his attempts to find that fulfillment and that perfection didn't work. He was always left with a sense of restlessness, left with a sense of failure. He was kind of a neurotic, but still. He was seeing clearly the mark of dukkha in all his attempts. It is the case with the Buddha's teaching that all actions that we perform with a view of self are intended to produce satisfactory results. After all, we wouldn't enter into them if they didn't. But results resultant experience is just as transient and controllable as any other experience. Being transient and uncontrollable, it comes to an end, we can't keep it going. We only have two options. We can either repeat it, or we have to conclude that it's unsatisfactory and move on to something else. And so we generate this perpetual restlessness. We try this, we try that. Always with a sense of trying to find the end of searching, that fulfillment that we sense should be there. Unfortunately, what we do in that process, we always step over the here and now. We project forward an idea of what it is that we want and then work towards getting it. Fair enough, that's how the world works. But in doing so, means that we reduce the here and now to a means to an end. It has no value on its own. It only has value as being used or manipulated in order to gain what we want. And what we want is the end of the search, fulfillment, that perennial happiness. But of course, the people that have had these spiritual epiphanies say, no, actually, what you're looking for is actually in the here and now. And so we're caught in a loop of dissatisfaction and restlessness, searching here, searching there, to find the end of our distress and the permanent happiness that we seek. And we are overlooking where that actual peace and happiness and grace actually reside, which is right here, right now. And our problem is, we're so caught up with this movement, this forward running. It's like trying to run to the horizon. You take one step towards the horizon, and the horizon moves back one step. You run full pelt towards the horizon runs full pelt the other way. You can never catch it up. But we never actually look directly at this moment. We never look directly at the here and now. There comes a time, though, when that search becomes a conscious search for enlightenment. The individual tries so many things, worldly things, to try and find that happiness. But there is an underlying generic pattern there that it always ends. It isn't satisfactory. It isn't controllable. Whatever it is that you produce dies. That's the nature of the world. I remember I was working in an office in the City of London, working for an investment banker, I think he was, and I confided in him one day that actually all I wanted was to find a tree to sit under and find out what the hell I was doing here in the first place. The man said to me, "Paul, that's exactly what I want as well. But I want to do it in comfort and with a certain amount of style." I wonder, looking back, whether he did find that comfortable, stylish tree to sit under to find out what he was doing here. But I suspect, I don't know, it's speculation on my part, that he's still collecting comfort and style, and he hasn't yet begun the spiritual search. And that's one of the problems, of course, is that life can tantalize us with the idea of success. You can even get a lot of success, and the vast majority of your life is deemed to be successful. But in doing so, you never actually come to the spiritual path, the spiritual way. The Buddha's life is actually a wonderful example of this, this whole spiritual search becoming conscious search for enlightenment. Remember that he was born into luxury, lived, 25, 27, 28 years of his life, enjoying all kinds of sensual pleasures, had a beautiful wife, gave birth to a lovely child, he was a prince, everything that he wanted was given to him. But at some stage he became aware of the facts the undeniable facts of disease, old age, and death. And in doing so, he renounced sensual existence, seeing the reality of these things, and began a search for enlightenment. He consciously became a spiritual seeker, seeing the harsh realities of life. In the course of his recluseship, he tried meditation. He surpassed and equaled his own teachers in the meditation techniques that they taught. But he rejected them because they did not lead to nirvana. He tried austerities for 6 years, till it said 1,000 parts of him was dead and only one part was alive. But he rejected it. Why? Because it did not lead to nirvana. It did not lead to the cessation of all searching. Finally, realizing that the austerities weren't working, he took a restorative meal and he gave up searching and struggle, sat down underneath the Bodhi tree, and he looked into the here and now that he had previously ignored because of all his striving and his searching. Guess what? It was successful. It did lead to the realization of nirvana. Now, in the Buddha's case, we find that there is path and no path. He started off without a path. It was just a conscious need to find the answer to life, the universe, and everything. He took teaching in meditation, so that has to fall under the category of path. But he tried them. They weren't successful. He gave them up. He moved on. He tried austerities also, which was regarded in the day as the way to become enlightened. He tried it. He found that it didn't work. He was searching. In the end, he gave up all these various techniques and looked into the heart of the moment. Non-path. So you can see from the Buddha's own case that he both took instruction and did his own thing. He tried to he tried things out, found they didn't work, moved on to something else, which is what all beings are actually involved with. One of the beautiful things that the Buddha did, and really the amazing thing that makes him stand out, is that he actually, even though he was a mixture of having taken instruction in things like meditation and finding his own way, ultimately he found his own way, but his many lifetimes of training to become the Buddha left him with an amazing mundane understanding, and is what he'd left us was a wonderful path that we can actually take in order to become enlightened. What we have to realize is that what the path can do, what practicing Vipassana can do, is stop all seeking for perfection within the world. So it stops all belief that you can find lasting, permanent happiness from doing something, from creating something, from producing something in the world. What it can't do is produce that final realization. I'll try and explain how it works. The Buddha's path, first, we must train the mind to pay attention, to stop its perpetual chasing of the horizon. In terms of ethics, it's restraining actions that are based in a rejection of the here and now. For instance, someone who undertakes an extramarital affair is not satisfied with what they have. They need something else. They want some excitement. They want an adventure in love and romance on the side, because that makes it a little bit more dangerous and a little bit more exciting. They want to live. They want to feel like they're alive. Well, in one sense, that is enlightenment, that sense of being here in the moment, in the here and now. But at what cost? The result is extreme guilt, dread, fear of being found out, and a lot of painful feelings in the here and now. That makes meditation very difficult. We also have to develop our mental culture to pay attention. We have to put aside the hindrances to meditation. The hindrances to meditation are yet another instance of chasing the horizon. Sensual desire, for instance, always looking for entertainment, always the mind wanting to entertain itself with stories, with memories, with sing songs in the heads, in the meditation. I'm sure you've all been there. And it does it because it wants pleasurable feeling. And it wants pleasurable feeling because there's something in the here and now that it doesn't like. And so the mind casts out, it projects, it moves, it introduces something that will be pleasurable, that will be satisfying. But of course, the problem is the pleasure always ends. As we know, feeling is transient. And so it has to reinvent itself, it has to recreate itself, it has to produce a new moment, a new song to sing, a new story to dwell on. And so that process is perpetual. So in order to practice vipassana, you have to learn how to pay attention to the right objects. You have to learn how to bring the mind into a happy, balanced place, the here and now, not casting off into the past, not casting off into the future. When we come to vipassana is an exploration of the here and now. So it isn't, if you like, searching for something, it is exploring something. And there's a tacit difference there. One very easy way of summing up what it is that we need to look at in vipassana is to look at experience from the point of view of the six, what the Buddha called the six sensory fields. The six sensory fields are eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Each sensory field is split into three little parts. Each has an object, base, and consciousness. Now, it might sound like it's a little bit tricky to comprehend, but actually it's very simple. Take eye, for instance. The object is shape and colour. The base is the actual eye itself. And the consciousness is seeing. Let me give you another example. Sensory field of ear. Sound is the object. Ear is the base. Hearing is the consciousness. Everyone knows they see. Everyone knows they hear. Everyone knows they taste. Everyone knows they smell. Everyone knows they touch. Mind is the sixth sensory field. You have mind as the base, mental objects such as thoughts, memories, feelings, perceptions, craving, they're the objects. And you have consciousness of what's going on in mind. Now those six sensory fields are what we look at when we explore our experience in vipassana. And we do it for a specific reason. What we want to do is see the generic pattern that is common to all experiences, whether they were in the long distant past, or whether they're cast out into the future, or whether they're present experiences, they are all anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Impermanent, unsatisfactory, and non-self. Let me give you a quick example. If you're outside during the break, you might have been smelling the scent of a rose flower. They're in bloom at the moment. In that experience, looked at from the point of view of vipassana, insight meditation, you have a number of things going on. Sensory field of sight, you have the shape and colour of the rose. In terms of the sensory field of smell, you have the scent of the rose. The sensory field of body, of touch. You actually touch the stem of the rose to bring the rose towards you in order to smell it. And in terms of mind, you have a pleasant feeling on smelling the scent of the rose. You have the intention to smell, the desire to smell. All these are mental objects. There might be a memory that might arise of some happy past occasion based on smelling the rose. Now all those small factors all go to make up, to mesh and make up the experience that we call me smelling the rose. But if we analyse closely all those experiences, we find that in each case, the smell didn't last, the sight didn't last, the touch didn't last, the memory didn't last, the intention to smell didn't last, the desire to smell didn't last. None of it actually lasted. Fleeting moments of experience arising and passing away. Also, we see that all these tiny instances all mesh together. They're conditioned and conditioning. For instance, in order to smell the rose, there had to be a prior intention to smell the rose. That intention just arises and passes away in the moment, and it's followed by an action, a physical action, a movement. That movement itself is transient, it doesn't last. Even the opening of the nostrils to take in the smell, it's just a moment of materiality, it arises and passes away. Now, the importance of seeing all this is that you begin to get a true insight into the fact that whatever it is that you wish for in the world, whatever actions you perform in order to obtain anything in the world, whatever it is that you obtain, the experience will be anicca, dukkha, anatta. It will be transient, unsatisfactory, non-self. What that does, and it does it brilliantly well, it cuts away the attachment to the results of our actions. And that's critical to understand that that's what it's doing. It's taking away the belief that I can find lasting satisfaction, permanent satisfaction, from anything within the world. But that's the most it can do. It can't make us enlightened. And to put this another way, I've got an illustration for you. Imagine you're in a darkened room. It's completely dark, there's no light anywhere. And you keep bumping into shapes. And you can't see where anything is at all. You're feeling things, but you really can't tell what they are. And then you're scrabbling around on the ground. And you finally pick up a torch. And you find the on switch. Aha, I have light. And so you cast the light upon something in the room. And you say, oh, that's a lampshade. And then you cast the light onto something else. You say, oh, that's a desk. And then to something else. You say, oh, that's a computer. And then to something else. You say, oh, that's a pot plant. Oh, that's very interesting. I'm beginning to find out what's in this room. But note, each time that you move the light, what you saw falls back dark again. And each time you move the light, whatever you saw falls into darkness. But you're left with the complete understanding that there is indeed a lampshade there. And if you cast the light back, you might say, oh, it's a lampshade. And I see what colour it is now. If you cast your light at the computer again, oh, I see what make of computer it is. Oh, I see that. Or you might look at the pot plants. Oh, it's an orchid. But each time you move the light, whatever it was you saw falls back into darkness, and you're left with the view, the belief, knowledge, yes, but it's not lit up, it's dark, but you know it's there. When we reach the end of the path, we're still in the darkness. Insight shows us that all these things are there, that sights are transient, that smells are transient, that perceptions are transient, that feelings are transient, that craving is transient. We see quite clearly in the practice, we gain insight into the fact that all transient things are dukkha. They're not worth clinging to, holding to, keeping, because they just pass away. We also gain insight into the fact that all of this is happening without a self. But when we come to the end of the training, we're still in the dark. We had insight into all these things, but the moment we moved on to something else, it fell dark again. But what we have achieved is we've got rid of the idea completely that you can find any lasting happiness within the world, and the scene is set. Imagine in that dark room, suddenly the blinds come crashing down and light floods that room. Immediately you go, you see, I was right, there is a lampshade there and it is purple. There is a desk there. There is a computer there. There is an orchid there. I was absolutely right the whole time. When the moment of enlightenment does come, it completely illuminates everything that you saw so briefly in the meditations. You see it completely, totally. It is so. That's the way it is. The Buddha was right. You've seen it completely and utterly. You have that total seeing, that epiphany. Whereas before, what you had were glimpses. Now, putting it all together, if I can, without the search, how could you have reached that point, that final point of giving up the belief that you could find lasting happiness within the world? You might possibly be able to do it, but it would take you aeons. What Buddha Dhamma does, what Vipassana does, it's a shortcut, because it tells you the generic pattern underlying all experiences. It shows you, you see for yourself, that there is nothing to be clung to in any of it. And once you've achieved that, then the scene is set for the final epiphany to occur. But no amount of effort on anyone's part can make it happen. There has to be looking, but it has to be looking free from any seeking of a result. And that's a very tricky thing to get to. A wise man in the East put it like this: "Now I understand why nothing was happening. The very effort was the barrier. The very ladder was preventing. The very urge to seek was the obstacle. Not that one can reach without seeking. Seeking is needed. But then comes a point when seeking has to be dropped. I stopped working on myself. A moment comes when you see the whole futility of effort. You have done all that you can and nothing is happening. You have done all that is humanly possible. Then what else can you do? In sheer helplessness, one drops all search. And the day search stopped, the day I was not seeking for something, the day I was not expecting something to happen, it happened." So to sum up, path versus no path is a completely irrelevant confusion and concern. Everyone is a mixture of path and no path. Everyone is actually searching for the peace and the grace and the happiness of enlightenment. And everyone is doing it to the best of their ability in the way that they see fit. There are as many paths as people. Everyone's journey is unique, although the patterns and the problems are shared by all. There's a beautiful quote I'd like to give you. "There is a question that a warrior, a spiritual seeker, has to ask. Does this path have a heart? All paths are the same. They lead nowhere. However, a path without a heart is never enjoyable. On the other hand, a path with a heart is easy. It does not make a warrior work at liking it. It makes for a joyful journey. As long as a man follows it, he is at one with it." Searching for the here and now is like looking for your glasses, only to find out that you've been wearing them all along. One non-path teacher said, "It is as plain as obvious as a gooseberry in the palm of your hand." The realization is that all is non-dual. No longer a perceptual contradiction is being made. The six sensory fields are not to be split into mine and to not mine. Nibbana, if you like, is the unbinding of the six sensory fields from the clutches of our dualistic fixation of me and that. The Buddha said in the Lesser Discourse on Emptiness, on the the emptiness of enlightenment. He said, there is only this degree of disturbance, that is to say, the six sensory fields, which, conditioned by life, are grounded on this very body itself. It might need some contemplation on what that means. There is only this degree of disturbance, that is to say, the six sensory fields, which, conditioned by life, are grounded on this very body itself. When the realization comes, you realize that is all there has ever been, the six sensory fields. In that moment, you uncover the infinite and eternal mystery for which you have always sought. You revel in the infinite and eternal mystery. You realize that you are the infinite and eternal mystery. Thou art that, and that is this. Thank you very much.